Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Before we begin today's morning show, we want to remind you that Wisconsin Public Radio's Spring Membership Drive is currently underway. And we want to remind you that when you support Wisconsin Public Radio, you are supporting WGTD. In other words, if WGTD is important to you and the programming that you hear on WGTD, then it's really crucial that you demonstrate that support with a pledge to Wisconsin Public Radio right now as part of their spring membership drive. You can actually donate anytime during the spring membership drive, and you can do so online at WPR.org, or you can donate over the phone at 1-888-202-2552, 1-888-202-2552. And they have a large group of volunteers standing by ready to take your call. And it's a very efficient process, does not take long at all, and it makes a great deal of difference. And be sure to mention that you are a listener to WGTD and The Morning Show. And with that, we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. No, we're not talking about Star Wars today, although it is May the 4th, but we are going to be talking about a whole lot of other things as well with Dr. Art Sear, who is, of course, a regular contributor to The Morning Show. He is the director of the Clausen Center at Carthage College, Clausen Distinguished Professor of World Business and Political Economy, author of After the Cold War. And it is always great to have Professor Sear here to offer his perspective on all kinds of issues and concerns both here and abroad. And Professor Sear, we welcome you back to The Morning Show.
Well, thank you, Greg. It's always great to be here. I really mean that.
Well, I'm glad we can have you. We appreciate you being so generous with your time. As it so happens, this visit to The Morning Show roughly coincides, not perfectly, but closely, with the conclusion of the first 100 days of the presidential administration of our new president, Donald Trump. And I thought it would be interesting to talk with you and get kind of some of your overall impressions of what these first 100 days have been like. Maybe just ahead of that, I suspect that you can offer a little longer view, historical view, in terms of why it is that we pay attention to this particular benchmark. We don't spend much time talking about the first week in office or the first month in office or the first year as much as we sort of earmark this as a significant milestone, the first 100 days. Maybe you can give us a little background on why we care about the first 100 days in particular, and if there's any particular reason to pay so much attention to this landmark.
Well, the media certainly cares about the first 100 days, especially lately. I'm not sure earlier presidents had quite this focus, and I'm not quite sure why.
I heard someplace that on public radio, I'm guessing, that that the more specific focus
that
it
must of be it, true, right?
Right. But the more specific focus actually dates back to FDR. Because his first 100 days, that was, in a sense, a really specific amount of time in which he really set out to accomplish certain important things in terms of combating the Great Depression. And that ever since, to varying degrees, we've paid attention to the first 100 days.
Yes, you provided an answer to the question. What I was saying was, I don't recall recent presidents, even though I'm an old guy, I don't consider Roosevelt recent. You're quite right. No, you've answered the question. There was a phenomenal amount of legislation that went through Congress during the first 100 days of the New Deal in early in 1933, after President Roosevelt was inaugurated. It's important to keep in mind that the Democratic Party was the distinct minority party, and that had been the case since the Civil War. Roosevelt transformed the political environment over time into one where the Democrats were the majority. I dare say today we don't have a solid majority party. He moved a lot of legislation through Congress. He was a brilliant legislative leader, among other things, whether one is an admirer or not. I do happen to admire him a lot. It was structurally an easier situation, I dare say, than anything since in executive congressional relations. The country was truly in a terrible political as well as economic crisis. I believe we are on the verge of a political revolution, something I like to emphasize, especially to younger conservatives who tend to dismiss or even denigrate his record. It was relatively easy. It's always tough to get things through Congress, but it was relatively easy because there was a tremendous crisis atmosphere in the country. People really were afraid, and fear itself, as he pointed out in his inaugural, was pervasive. Also, the Republican Party had been reduced. I think Senate Republicans could meet in a dining room, and House Republicans could meet in a small hall, and the environment was, it was a very opportune environment, but that shouldn't minimize at all the tremendous accomplishments of the 100 days and afterwards. Lyndon Johnson, who was obsessed with his hero and great mentor, FDR, would emphasize how important it was to get legislation through Congress. I don't believe we were in the crisis then that we had been in the 30s, but that there was a lot of conscious references to the first 100 days then. For whatever reason, I don't think our quite recent presidents have had the same media emphasis on 100 days. And President Trump has tended to minimize the importance of the 100 days, as I'm sure you know.
Right. So what are your impressions of this administration thus far? And we've talked about this to some extent, but now with, as you rightly point out, so much of the media looking not just at the latest tweets or the latest executive order or whatever is sort of the headline of the day, but are also taking, in a sense, a longer view of what has been accomplished and not accomplished over these 100 days. What are your impressions of how this White House has functioned and what this administration has managed to accomplish thus far?
The most important point is that our system has functioned despite all the predictions of trouble, difficulty, disaster, the end of the world that continues to characterize a lot of the major media, which is obviously hostile to Trump and his administration. And that certainly includes public radio and public television, in my opinion. A conservative columnist, I would commend to you and our listeners, is Charles Krauthammer, who wrote an important column within the last few weeks, I think, about how the system is working. Congress is certainly not knuckled under to President Trump, despite his aggressive style, to put it politely. He didn't try to send the 82nd Airborne into federal courthouses and onto federal judicial grounds after losing steadily on immigration and other matters to federal judges. So we're not a banana republic, at least not yet, and we can all feel good about that. The system is working. In terms of his supporters, and he has a very strong base of support, many millions of Americans voted for Trump and continue to support him, polls indicate that while he's not popular overall, he remains very popular with his base and with self-identified Republicans at large.
So
that's the most, you know, I really try to be thoughtful about these things. That's the most thoughtful answer I can give you, and it certainly would be wasting our time and whoever's listening to, you know, engage in the usual complaints about Trump and his style.
Right, right. That has been my impression, too, that those who supported Mr. Trump in November, to a large extent, remain as supportive of him now as they were. In other words, it would seem that they got what they wanted. Those who voted for President Trump probably had certain expectations about the kind of president he would be, and at least generally speaking, it seems like that's holding true, that he is being consistent with who he is, even if on certain specific matters he finds himself forced to compromise or waffle or so on.
Yeah. My own view is that the Democratic Party has changed dramatically since the 60s and even since Bill Clinton's very successful presidential career in the 1990s. Our parties are moving steadily in opposite ideological directions. They're ideologically less diverse. And the Democratic Party, among its many current problems, is the fact that it's been captured by the intellectual class to an unprecedented degree, not just academics, but advocates who look to ideas and issues of fairness and lifestyle, not so much a full stomach and whether you have a job or not and are able to feed your family, the issues that define the Democratic Party. In earlier periods, from my point of view, I've heard more than one academic, including very fine colleagues of ours at Carthage, say, well, he's an idiot, he's a fool. And this atmosphere that I'm smarter than you are, I believe, has come to pervade to an unfortunate degree the Democratic Party, and it's driven a lot of average Americans away. That was a good part of his appeal. Whatever's Trump's faults, and he has many, and I'm not going to discuss his personality on your program. I did that once before more than once before he was elected. He's not stupid, and he's very, very shrewdly appealing to a very large sector of the electorate. That's how he won in the Electoral College, and he continues to do so.
Yeah.
Especially given the nature of our audience, I really do try hard to give myself, but also other people and just our students, something to think about.
Absolutely. No, I think that is a very worthwhile point and something that a lot of people should be thinking about, including people who are on that particular side of the political aisle, who care about the well-being of their party and their future successes, if any.
Well, and the Democrats will come back. Our system does work. All Americans should be, at this point in our history, all Americans should be confident that, in fact, we've come through a hell of a lot worse in this country, including the Great Depression, with our values and Constitution and system intact. And I'm absolutely confident we're going to survive whatever problems we have now. And the current chief executive does present problems in terms of style and temperament and approach to things.
Right.
I will say that.
What would your advice be to the Democratic Party in terms of were they to have a come to Jesus moment, but I mean,
I don't think that's the answer either.
Right.
But I mean, not explicitly.
Right. But I mean, the a sense of, that's where we've lost our way. That's how this happened. We need to get back to, the Democratic Party of old. How do they do that? How does a political party realign itself? I mean, does it consciously do that, or does it just wait for the forces of history to buffet it in that direction?
Well, I wish I knew for sure. I could go on to a great, successful political career and own somebody in academia in some ways. At the current moment is the last person practical politician should be consulting on how to get elected. But politicians who've been successful have put together, in effect, new coalitions. And that includes President Obama. He was able to mobilize not just African-American, but other ethnic minorities, and not just Hispanics, to vote for him, self-consciously ethnic minorities, in a way that put him over the top. A brilliant politician serves as a catalyst, and I think he provides an example, a great orator who appeals to our best, truly did appeal to our best instincts. It's a major reason why I voted for President Obama.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Clinton, a genius at appealing psychologically to working people, minimizing the activist divisions that seem to currently define American life, a tremendous appeal to authority. I don't think his defense and military policies were particularly worthwhile once in office, but he was remarkably effective at lining up retired military officers. It's against the law for active military people to politicize too obviously or publicly. Current and retired police officers, law enforcement figures, the people who are most hostile to you are the people that you should cultivate. Obama and Bill Clinton represent charismatic figures. And I'm confident one will emerge. And it won't necessarily be Elizabeth Warren, although I would, she's the obvious major name and prominent figure for the next campaign.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Art Sear, Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College and Director of the Clausen Center. And as you know, on roughly a monthly basis, Professor Sear joins us here to offer his analysis and thoughts on various issues and decisions. I really appreciated the column that you wrote several weeks ago on the confirmation of Neil Gorsuch to the U.S. Supreme Court, in which you talked about how the Supreme Court can be viewed in certain ways, and in terms of what its function should be, and who the men and women who populate the bench of the U.S. Supreme Court, how they should view themselves, and the role that they should play in this democracy. I really thought you offered some good thoughts. I want you to, if you would, just kind of share some of your central concerns about the U.S. Supreme Court as it functions right now.
Well, it's not functioning as well as it has in the past, in that political ideology really has come to pervade the current Supreme Court. It's become highly politicized, especially since the 1980s. It's been very controversial throughout its history in one way or another, but especially since the 1950s, as the court became more centrally involved for the first time in a long time in divisive issues beyond economics. I think politicians are extremely important to making the system work. We used to have politicians, those who successfully achieved electoral office at the federal level, populating the Supreme Court on a pretty regular basis. And that has gone away over time, given the way the dynamics of our system have changed. So we now have what I've been talking about, activists, academics, people with an ideological point of view who are professionally qualified but don't build coalitions. Hence, we have five fork divisions on a regular basis. It's important, therefore, to keep in mind that the vast majority of Supreme Court decisions are, in fact, not 5-4, but 9-0, 7-2, 6-3. 5-4 is when they are really crucial cases, and that, unfortunately, has come together with some of the most intense and explosive issues today. The Warren Court in the 1950s was extremely activist, extremely successful. To some extent, the current atmosphere is a reaction to the liberal Warren Court. However, there were politicians on that court, as well as highly qualified jurists who made important decisions. The most dramatic example, which I therefore cite fairly regularly, maybe too often when I write columns, is the famous Brown versus Board of Education decision in 1954 overturning an 1890s decision which had confirmed racial segregation. The court led by Earl Warren determined unequivocally that racial segregation was illegal at the federal level and therefore throughout the country. That was originally going to be a 5-4 decision. Earl Warren was the governor of California, a longtime politician. He'd been the Republican vice presidential nominee with Tom Dewey in 1948 on the ticket that lost to Truman. Eisenhower named him to the Supreme Court early on. Now, Ike said publicly and is widely quoted as saying, you know, that was the biggest damn fool mistake I ever made. My best understanding is he only said it once. He said it at the end of a dinner for elected politicians in Congress from the South, almost uniformly Democrats, when he knew he would be quoted in the press. I don't believe he meant that. Eisenhower was a one-man hall of mirrors. He was extraordinarily successful in a time when the South was overwhelmingly Democratic, unlike today. He was extraordinarily successful in the South. He and Herbert Hoover were the only two Republicans who had actually taken several Southern states. When you look at his record, Warren and also Brennan and Stewart, the Supreme Court justices he appointed, were consensual. They were reformers, and they were very, very impressive Supreme Court justices. So it starts with presidential leadership. Hmm. And I think Eisenhower was a very great president. He was also remarkably deceptive and devious, and he got things done for that reason in Washington.
Hmm.
So that's my view.
Right.
We really do need more politicians on the Supreme Court, if I can actually state something briefly for a change. And I hope that, if not President Trump, his successors will see that point. It's self-evident. It's hard to do, but that's, you know, the buck stops with the president. It is a tough job if you're actually doing it. And we really need that, a sort of change of definition of what makes for a good justice.
And I think what you're saying, because I think a lot of people just hearing those words would recoil from them, the idea that, well, that's what would make the world a better place if we had politicians on the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yeah.
But because I think for some people, they don't maybe make the distinction that you are between what a politician is and what an ideologue is.
Bismarck, I think I'm quoting correct, Otto von Bismarck, the great German leader, not inherently a Democrat, but he did modernize Germany and avoid modern dictatorship. He said legislation and sausages, you really don't want to know in detail how they're made.
Mm. In that,
and
in
the fact that politicians has become a dirtier word than it used to be,
is
part of our problem today.
Right.
We've got all these activists in both parties who've come to have far more influence than they should have, in my opinion.
So I guess that's the thing that, I mean, politics right now in our country is so dominated by activists and ideologues, and you are thinking about politicians in a more classic sense of the word as people who solve problems and get things done.
Yeah, right. And if you're not listening, it's a little hard to get things done. And if you're not willing to log roll, horse trade, all the colorful imagery on how the system works, you're not going to get things done. Legislatively, you're going to get things done the way President Obama did through endless executive orders. A big factor in Trump's Electoral College victory and his continued support, and he's been rapidly rolling them back. Executive orders are easy to do. It feeds your ego as well as your issues. Much easier than trying to get things through Congress anytime. But if you get laws through Congress, as President Obama is demonstrating in hindsight, it's tough to repeal the Affordable Care Act because, in fact, it is law.
Right.
Get a law made, buddy. Get a law made, and that's your legacy.
Right, right. I want to close this part by reading a quote that you included in the column from current Chief Justice John Roberts, where he said, "The founders of the United States were practical statesmen, not metaphysical philosophers. The academics and activists who make up today's Supreme Court should regularly be reminded of this." The last line is yours, but the first line was that of Chief Justice Roberts.
You make me very nervous because you are such a careful, serious student. You know what I've written better than I do sometimes. I believe I started that column by quoting new Justice Gorsuch, I think it's pronounced, that we're not politicians in robes. That was very telling.
Right.
He's intellectually distinguished. He's the justice from Central Casting. It's going to be hard to challenge this guy in the media. But in fact, they are politicians in robes.
Or you wish they
John
were.
John Marshall.
Yeah. I mean, you wish they were anyway. I mean, you wish they would
well,
see
to some
themselves
extent, they are. But yeah, exactly. I thought that was a telling quote from someone.
Right.
That's the nature of the accomplished professional that we today appoint to the court. Of course, they're politicians.
Hmm.
At some level, he probably realizes that you don't go that far to get on the Supreme Court with a lot of without a lot of interpersonal and professional political skills, selling yourself, lobbying, persuading actual and potential mentors and seniors.
Right.
No, the law has got to be one of the most highly political professions.
Hmm. Let's talk about a couple other domestic issues, and then we have matters of the rest of the globe to talk about as well. Two points that are important in considering the priorities of President Trump. One of them, well, first of all, we should mention, of course, that a new effort is underway and perhaps may pass in the House of repealing the Affordable Health Care Act. And, of course, it remains to be seen if that will be accomplished. And, of course, it still has to it faces a battle in the Senate, but we'll see how that happens. But more generally speaking, President Trump, of course, has announced plans to dramatically simplify the tax code. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, has generated a great deal of conversation. And he has spoken repeatedly. This is something we talked about in this program with Professor Maltsev the last time he was on. The fact
that
President Trump was also thinking of and very much intending to scale back the amount of regulation that is currently at play, which he feels is a major hindrance to the U.S. economy. It makes us less than competitive on a global scale. What is your sense of both of those? I mean, are these worthwhile avenues to pursue in terms of safeguarding the well-being of the U.S. economy in particular?
Yes, I think they're worthwhile and reflect public concerns in our system. We seem people who tend to think in abstract terms, especially when you get paid to do that, are always looking for constants, themes, trends that can be measured and aren't readily apparent. And it's important to keep that in mind when talking to somebody like me. I believe that every 25 years or so, we have great pressure for tax reform, at least starting with the Great Depression, which significantly increased tax rates on higher income people. The Truman administration raised them higher because of the unexpected need to pay for the second, Korean War, when we were already burdened with a much heavier national debt and deficits as a ratio to our assets and federal revenues, a much higher ratio than we're facing today, still, although we're approaching those earlier levels. In any case, they put emphasis on the upper income brackets, and the top marginal rate was about 90%, which nobody actually paid, or almost nobody, because we had loopholes throughout the system. So nobody paid those high rates, but that shows what a different world it was. John F. Kennedy advocated a dramatic decrease in taxes for regular people paying taxes and also the corporate tax rate, which was quite controversial, but it was popular, and Lyndon Johnson got it through after President Kennedy was assassinated. The Reagan tax cuts, which James Baker got at that point, Secretary of the Treasury got through Congress, were also extremely important. We're overdue for another major tax overhaul. Lyndon Johnson, James Baker, these were extraordinarily talented politicians and legislative movers and shakers and achievers. We're overdue for tax overhaul, according to my view of how our system works. And I think something will go through. It will probably reversing where this began. In my time frame, it'll be on balance favorable to upper income tax brackets, I would imagine, especially with the Republicans' control of Congress. It doesn't mean it's bad, but it does mean I think it's overdue. You get tax reform, everything's cut. A big selling point for Baker, especially, as I recall, was closing loopholes. You get tax reform through, and then special interests, including National Public Radio, including the National Association of University Professors, including AARP, including all kinds of corporate interests. Everybody is an interest in all kinds of people, not just cartoon fat cats. I believe there should be some kind of special dispensation, if not an income tax in some other area. So we'll have more and more loopholes, and then we'll have tax reform again.
That's
part of how this. I hope this is clear.
Right.
As usual, I'm kind of rambling.
So a framework gets created, and then it erodes over time, in a sense, as loopholes are created. And loopholes. That's kind of a good image, actually.
It's a traditional image. I didn't make it up.
Right.
Log
right.
rolling and
sure.
pork barrel and all kinds of other colorful stuff.
Right.
And the beleaguered taxpayer is a traditional image. A cliche that has not been around, I think, for many years, but used to be pervasive in the press, was John Q. taxpayer. I don't believe this indicates gender oppression and discrimination, but a kind of classic inclusive image of the citizenry. Traditionally, males were more easy to caricature without trouble than females, who should be treated with respect. Anyway, John Q. Public would be some guy, some middle-aged balding guy, sometimes smoking a cigar, but wearing a barrel because he had no clothes left because of the tax man from Washington.
Right.
Naturally, taxes are resented and should be.
Right. And is there something, however, inherently beneficial to simplifying the tax system, to making it simple? Why is that better?
Why wouldn't it be better?
Well, I asked you first. Why is simplifying the tax?
I would never ask that question, because filling out your tax forms is more burdensome and difficult. You're more likely to make mistakes. The accountant will charge you more. To me, that's self-evident, sir.
Oh, well, I suppose, but I mean,
only academics think more complicated is better. So I guess it's a perfectly appropriate question. Why don't we spend the rest of the time together discussing complexity?
Right.
Yeah, no, in this case, complexity is not better.
Right. Well,
I hope that's clear.
Well, I understand what you're saying.
And that's also just, people want to pay lower taxes on the regulation front.
Right. I guess that's part of what I'm saying is, if the point is how much do you pay taxes, how many taxes do you pay, and if the point is also keeping our country afloat and the government afloat and functioning so we get enough money from people, in other words, the revenue stream, if those are the two most important matters, then does it just naturally follow that simplifying the tax system is to the benefit of both of those concerns? That's my question.
Yes, but actually things are more complicated than that, because we fund at the federal level especially, I believe state and local governments since the Great Recession have become much more into balance. And we may actually have a national surplus at that level, but where you have federal deficits, a rapidly, and I mean really rapidly now, growing federal debt. So we have to be able to issue debt. It's not just income and spending, sir, but we have to borrow money. And Uncle Sam and Aunt Sam, I'm careful to add nowadays, whatever other Sam you want, we got to be able to borrow, all sarcasm aside. And the creditworthiness of the United States has to remain grade A. It has to be right there at the top. So that's an important complicating factor to keep in mind. But we've got to start paying down the deficit at some point. The third rail, not just Social Security and Medicare, the third rail of politics today in the system is paying down the deficit, paying down the debt and reducing the deficit. Eisenhower was able to do that with remarkable success. Bill Clinton was able to do that thanks to tremendous economic growth. And at some point, we need a president who's going to be able to do that. Managing debt and deficits, that is rapidly emerging, I think, as the number one public policy issue.
Wow. Let's talk about the rest of the world, if we may.
Yeah. Oh, let me mention as well, we pay our taxes with great reliability. There's very, very little fraud in this country. We're discussing France. I brought up France in the election off the air. A national tradition in France is cheating the tax collector, not paying your taxes. Americans are remarkably law-abiding. We are a relatively low-taxed nation. A lot of bellyaching about the corporate tax, but the biggest players are located offshore to a significant degree, either in whole or in part. Regulation, we're a relatively unregulated nation. A lot of them, particularly vexing and controversial Obama regulations, are going right away. But in fact, we do not have a lot of regulation in this country compared to Europe. Every other country in the world. We are very, very free in this country. It's why we're a magnet for investment, and we can fund this, in literal terms, very large debt and deficit trend.
Let's talk about the rest of the world with our time dwindling. And, of course, you are such an expert on the Korean Peninsula, so we should make sure we have enough time to talk at least just a little bit about the most recent belligerency from the North Koreans with certain nuclear tests and so on that, of course, caused a fair amount of alarm, not only to North Korea's neighbors, but, of course, to places far and wide. Typically, you tend to, I think, emphasize the sort of fragile state of affairs in North Korea and that often what we're talking about with them is a lot of bluster, and not the means to follow up on the bellicose threats they make. I mean, is that still, you think, the case with North Korea?
Yes, the armistice is held since 1953. There's been, thank God, there's been no repeat of the horrific three-year Korean War from 50 to 53. Again, thanks to Dwight Eisenhower, which we can talk about more if you wish. We tend to overlook South Korea, which North Korea wants. They want to deal directly with Washington, and we quite rightly have resisted this. There are six powers, including Russia and China, that we insist participate in any major negotiations, and we continue to do so. South Korea, of course, is one of them, and we tend to overlook the tremendously important developments in South Korea. President Park, to her great misfortune, was impeached and convicted for malfeasance in office and has been arrested, and I guess will be tried. A terrible personal tragedy, but the institutions of the country have survived. They're approaching an election, which is very hard fought. A country that was a brutal dictatorship until fairly recently, like the 1980s, is now, democracy is intact, it's functioning again. And the tremendous success story of South Korea should receive more attention. It's one reason I write about the Republic of Korea, a truly great and important, and I mean really important, ally of this country since the Korean War. We need to devote more attention to the South.
Mm-hmm. And as for these most recent nuclear tests by North Korea, we should not be unduly concerned?
We should be concerned. You were referring, I think, to general hostilities commencing again on the peninsula. No, we should be concerned, and I'm sure we are concerned. We have taken action in the past, and since Americans worry so much about so many things, to my great dismay, in 2010, the Israelis took out, with brilliant effectiveness as usual, and not just from the air, they took out a nuclear weapons facility that the Syrians were, it was being built in Syria with technical assistance from North Korea. As usual, there was close military and intelligence cooperation with the Americans, and I believe the press conference that was held to justify this action, providing chapter and verse on the very dangerous activity of the Syrians and Koreans, was at the State Department, as I recall. I hope we have as many effective agents on the ground in North Korea as we can. We do tend to minimize human intelligence currently, but I'm reassured by the fact that when the nuclear threshold is being breached, we have pretty consistently taken action. And I think we will in the case of North Korea. I think that would be true of a Trump administration and an Obama administration, which was the administration that collaborated in the strike in against the nuclear facility in the Mideast.
You made brief mention earlier of the election that is about to occur in the nation of France, with, of course, what part of what is remarkable there is that the two remaining candidates, neither of whom are from what have been thought of as the traditional mainstream parties in France, and of course one of them is Ms. Le Pen, who is essentially from kind of the hard right. It's interesting to think about that election against the backdrop of other elections in Europe, which maybe suggests that while still there is this rise of nationalism and populism in general, but some of the more recent elections, for instance, the one in the Netherlands, suggest that it is not an unstoppable juggernaut, and that in fact
it's not a juggernaut at all, my friend. In reviewing the news to answer your question, reviewing the news to get ready for the always interesting and challenging conversation with you, I learned that there was a 3-hour debate between Ms. Le Pen and the principal adversary, now Macron. And I think that's terrific, a 3-hour debate among two highly intelligent, aggressive French leaders talking about issues. It's a good lesson for us in our own TV and soundbite and soap opera culture when it comes to elections and other serious matters. France is not historically a two-party system. It's a multi-party system. Governments fell regularly after the war. France was in some danger of falling apart, literally, when Charles de Gaulle came back as president, one of the really great political and military leaders of the 20th century, the leader of the Free French in World War II. Very impossible leader to deal with often, although Eisenhower succeeded in doing just that. Since then, he established a strong chief executive in the Fifth Republic. It's one of the few presidencies in the industrialized world that's even stronger than the U.S. president. And since de Gaulle's tenure ended in 68, in the midst of great domestic unrest and chaos and riots and demonstrations, nonetheless, the system has held, and nobody is worrying about France falling apart today. Nobody is worrying about a communist takeover in France. The institutional legacy remains extremely strong, and that was not characteristic of modern France until just about a half century ago. That's the thing to keep in mind. They're a very important ally of the U.S. De Gaulle, for political reasons and reasons of ego, in my view, withdrew very dramatically from NATO. France kicked the headquarters literally out of Paris, which is why they're in Belgium in Castel, outside Brussels. France has rejoined, during the Obama administration, rejoined NATO. They're one of, contrary to the cartoon image that, I'm sorry to say, continues to be prominent in this country, was way too prominent in the U.S. military in the 60s. I saw that directly from officers who should have known better. The France are underestimated as a military power. Big mistake. They're proving currently in brutal small fighting in parts, more than one part of Africa, that they have a very, very, as always, a very, very effective military. And not just the French Foreign Legion. After 9/11, French aircraft were immediately patrolling U.S. and Canadian skies to free up our long-range, high-tech aircraft for strikes against the Taliban and al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. They're a very important and powerful ally of the U.S. I don't think Le Pen will win, but even if she does, I don't think these institutional ties will change. Mm-hmm. I don't think so.
Right.
I hope you don't have one of the opportunities you enjoy to quote me back to myself.
Yeah, we'll see about that. Let's finish with Russia. You wrote a column in which you, again, are trying to calm people down who tend to be overreacting to the presence of Russia and maybe, well, you call it the demonization of Russia. And, of course, I think what you're saying here is one can intensely dislike and maybe even despise Mr. Putin and what he stands for. But the demonization of Russia itself maybe carries that a little too far and also, in a sense, blows way out of proportion their significance kind of on the world stage. Am I fairly characterizing what you're saying?
I think there are areas where our interests overlap concerning especially developments in the Mideast, not just but including Syria. Historically, they're cautious about using military force. They're not a country where militarism took control as it did in so many other countries in the 20th century. Putin is a KGB killer who made his bones in East Germany, which was perhaps the most intense, totalitarian, most ugly, and in some ways dangerous totalitarian regime since World War II. Certainly a pervasive, thoroughgoing dictatorship. A huge percentage of the population of East Germany were working for the KGB. It was just an extraordinarily powerful and ruthless regime. This is where this guy made his reputation and started moving up. He's a killer. And the USA Today special report of a couple days ago confirms that. Russian killers, Russian hitmen that are undeniably associated with the Kremlin, at least to a degree, have carried out a large number of murders since Putin took over. I don't think if he went down, the alternative would be any better, probably worse. Mm-hmm. He has stabilized the country, and he's had remarkable success in, to a degree, strengthening an economy that was in total collapse, in free fall. And that would have been real trouble for us had that continued when he took over in around 2000, that all changed.
One of the things
That's all I was saying. We demonize them. They don't control our politics. In evaluating failed presidential candidates, without mentioning any current names, in 1968, Hubert Humphrey lost a very close election to Richard Nixon. Had it gone on for another week or two, Humphrey would have won incredibly. Given the Vietnam War, given riots in the streets, given hatred and fear of Lyndon Johnson, Humphrey was behind not only Nixon by about 30 points or more, but also George Wallace, the third-party racist insurgent in 68, just a phenomenal politician. I'm a great admirer of Humphrey and voted for him with enthusiasm in 68, another really great leader in my view. He said, when he conceded the election early in the morning, "I've done my best, I've lost, Mr. Nixon has won." That's what he said. No belly aching. No soap opera crying in the media, no finger pointing at the head of the FBI or the communists who then controlled a lot. I've done my best. Look for a candidate who says, "I will do my best," and that's it. I'm not going to be trying to pass the buck, pass the blame, engage in highly emotional diatribes, trying to do everything but accept the fact that I'll do my best, I'll win or lose. After the fact, if you've won, be modest. If you've lost, I lost. Look for a woman or man who talks that way nowadays.
So we have 1 minute. So the fact that the Russians very likely played a role in the results. I mean.
No, I don't accept that at all.
No. Okay.
Okay. Easy answer in the last minute. No. They're a scapegoat. We blame them. They make mischief. They're not our friends, but they did not play a role, in my opinion. Everybody should make up their own mind about that.
So the election would have turned out as it did, even without their mischief.
I don't know how the election would have turned out. We academics like to talk about counterfactuals because we can speculate about what might have happened. I don't know what would have happened if they hadn't made mischief, but I don't think they were a principal or even a major factor in Trump's victory in the Electoral College. Keep in mind that Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by a significant margin.
Right. Well, someday we'll have to have a longer conversation about that.
I can always tell when you disagree and I'm irking you. That's why I always thank you for inviting me back.
I'm always glad to have you here, and it's your opinions I'm much more interested in, as are our listeners. Dr. Art Sear, the Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business and Director of the Clausen Center at Carthage College. We look forward to having you back next month and actually next week. Unfortunately, there's not time to even say that.